Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. This week, I am talking to Domingo Morrell, who is the author of Takeover, Race, Education, and American Democracy. The book is published by Oxford University Press, and I have such a pleasure to have on the phone Domingo. Domingo, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've enjoyed the book a lot and have been looking forward to talking to you about it. Why don't you share just a little bit about yourself, what your background is, and where you are now?
So I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Rutgers University, Newark. Before working on my PhD, I worked in higher education for about 11 years in Rhode Island, working for special programs for students who otherwise would not have the credentials or the kind of financial support to be able to attend college. And so that's a little bit of my background. And in addition to that, in Rhode Island, I was involved in local and state politics as well. So I come with that type of experience to the academy.
Yeah, and it's reflected absolutely throughout this book, both in what you did and also your perspective. As the title suggests of your book, this book is about state takeovers of local schools. I wonder if you'd explain a bit about how this works exactly. What gives a governor the authority to do this, and how often has this happened over the last several decades? So, like on a real basic level, what is a school takeover?
Yeah. So, usually, school districts are run by some form of local government, whether it's school board. You also have local elected officials outside of the school board, like the mayor, city council, and so forth, who are responsible for governing the schools. But what we saw happen in the 1980s was this transition to more state control of states intervening in local schools. And what happens is that states start to pass laws, beginning again in the 1980s, to allow the governor and commissioners of higher education and state legislatures to take over local school districts, which they deemed as not adequately providing an education for the students in that particular district. And since the 1980s, we've had about slightly over 100 school districts that have been taken over, many more hundreds that have been threatened to be taken over. And what was so interesting for me in this project is that perhaps we'll get into this some more in this conversation, that takeovers disproportionately affect Black and Latino communities, and in particular, Black communities.
Now, you argue in the book that as you're just suggesting, that this is not just about school management, but it's also about democracy and all the issues related to democracy. I wonder if you talk a little bit more about why a takeover is an important area of research for those interested in democracy, not just those that are interested in the management and operations of public schools.
Yeah, and so when I first came to study this project, this is my dissertation project at Brown, and as a political scientist, naturally, I'm looking at this through a political lens. But there are many reasons why we should be looking at not only just the takeovers, but education in itself as a political project. And so in terms of state takeovers, the angle that I start to examine this from is school boards. And we know that for communities, and particular historically marginalized communities, the school board plays a critical a role in the process of political empowerment. So where Black and Latino communities historically have been excluded from participating in the political process, we see that their point of entry into the public sphere begins with the local schools. and particularly the school board. And so before we get a Black mayor, for example, we get Black city council members. And before we get Black city council members, we get Black school board members. And so the when states take over local school districts, they can employ, they employ one of three potential options. Either one, they leave the school board in place, they elect the school board in place. They can remove the school board and appoint a new one, and they can remove the school board and not replace it at all. And for Black communities, we see that they face, not only are they more likely to experience a takeover of their local schools, but they're more likely to experience the most disruptive form of a local school, of a takeover. So they're more likely to have their school boards removed, and more likely to have their school boards abolished and not replaced at all. And so that made me really think about this, kind of think about the implications of a state takeover on local politics, since the schools have been a critical part of the community's political empowerment.
Now, you have two specific cases that you look at, in addition to some other data, which is Newark, New Jersey, and Central Falls, Rhode Island. Why these two locations to focus on in your study? What makes them interesting places?
Yeah, so Central Falls, it was a puzzling place. So Central Falls is in Rhode Island. And I had been, you know, as I mentioned, I was involved in local and state politics in Rhode Island. And I had known for some time, had seen for some time that the Latino community in Central Falls, which was represented the majority of the population in the city of Central Falls, was very much not part of the political process in Central Falls for many years. And by around 2009, started to see that this was changing, and that the Latino community had increased its members on the city council and were at that point on the verge of electing a Latino mayor. And what I had noticed was that this was all being kind of, this mobilization was being ignited by school level politics. And, you know, from a kind of political science perspective, again, this is not that surprising, because we know that, again, for Black and Latino communities and others, the school board is the entry point. And so that wasn't what was so much puzzling to me. What was puzzling was that the majority Latina school board in Central Falls was there because it was appointed by the state. And the state had, after the state had taken over the school district several years ago, and it's still under state control. And so that school board is majority Latina school board, but it's there because the state had taken over the school district, appointed a new board, gotten rid of the all white school board that was there before. And the first sign of Latino representation in the city of Central Falls was because of this takeover. And so that was puzzling to me, because what we had known, although there were no systematic studies of takeovers at that point, what we did know about takeovers were that they were kind of detrimental. And this based on detrimental to local democracy and local communities. And this was based on case studies of cities like Baltimore, Detroit, Compton, and so forth. And so that was what was puzzling to me with the city of Central Falls. And so that's why I chose that city. But then the second city I chose, and in this book, I talk about Newark, but in my dissertation, I had focused on other cities as well in the state of New Jersey. And New Jersey just made sense for several reasons. It was the first state to take over, first state to pass a takeover law in the 1980s, the first state to take over a school district. Jersey City School District in 1989, and then the Newark School District, in Newark being the largest city in the state in 1995. And Newark is very similar to other cities that have been taken over in terms of size, demographic makeup, and just kind of like race political history. Very similar to Detroit, very similar to Baltimore, very similar to Oakland and some of these other cities that have experienced takeover.
Yeah, I wonder if you talk a little bit more about that and that aspect of Newark, New Jersey, because the racial and ethnic politics of the city matter a lot here to your study. I wonder if you could just sort of maybe talk a little generally about what some of the major indicators are that politics in Newark has changed from the 1960s to the 1990s, because there's this parallel thing going on in the book about you know, how the schools are changing and the city politics are changing. And Newark really, you know, has such an interesting story to tell here. So you know, maybe briefly, you know, what was going on in the 1960s and what was going on in the 1990s in the city of Newark?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so when I start to puzzle through kind of these questions about takeovers and why they happen, the one question that really comes up is, so why takeovers? And why takeovers in particularly beginning in the 1980s? And in order to understand that, we need to go back a little bit in history. And what I argue in the book is that by the 1960s, obviously American politics started to change. And at the local level, what we see is this emergence of Black political empowerment in cities throughout the United States. It's not until the 1970s where we start to see Black mayors and so forth. But in the 1960s, African-American populations are gaining political empowerment, and they're doing this through the schools. Again, that's no surprise because we know that before we have a Black mayor in Washington, D.C., before we have Black mayor in Newark, New Jersey, before we have a Black mayor in Detroit and so forth, we first have Black representatives on the school board. And so this is what's starting to happen in the 1960s. Blacks representing the majority of the population in many cities, and they're starting to gain political empowerment in these cities. At the same time, at the national level, we see under Lyndon Johnson an embrace of, you know, obviously a civil rights agenda. And that embrace of a civil rights agenda creates this bridge, really, from the national government down to the local government. And there, obviously, Lyndon Johnson, the Democratic Party now starts to kind of embrace African Americans. We'll bring in African Americans to the Democratic Party as an important part of its coalition. So while this is happening at the state level, we see conservatives really start to consolidate power there. And in part, they're doing this because there's really the national government has embraced a civil rights kind of agenda. And at the local level, we see that the growth of Black political empowerment, which is becoming an important part of the Democratic coalition. And so the home really for conservatives is at the state level. And so under Nixon, we see, you know, what is known as New Federalism, which they devolve under the Nixon administration, start to devolve power from the federal government to the state government. And under Reagan, we see that pick up as well. And so this idea of trying to shift control from the federal government to the states is a deliberate effort to kind of break up this national urban axis that's taking place. And then we also start to see the emergence of these conservative policy organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation. These all emerge in the 1970s, again, is a response to what's happening at the national and local level. And by focusing at the state level, conservatives start to centralize power at the state level. Again, all in response to what's happening in U.S. cities, and particularly in response to Black political empowerment, because Black political empowerment posed two critical problems. One was, again, that they're becoming an important part of the Democratic coalition. And two is that these communities are being successful in demanding more resources at the local level, particularly when it comes to education. And because they're able to win court cases to secure more resources, this is problematic for conservatives because they view that these resources are coming from, you know, their suburban taxpayers going, and this money is going down to the city. So this form of redistribution that they're not too fond of. And so takeovers emerge out of this kind of climate where the Black communities represent a political kind of a problem for conservatives at the state level, and takeovers become part of the solution to break up that political empowerment.
And this really does place us into Newark, New Jersey in the 1990s. And I wonder if you could talk about the justification for the state of New Jersey and their takeover of the Newark public schools in 1995. How did the state justify this decision? And how did they explain their reasoning for this? And how did local residents respond? What was the local response to what was a major decision about a very large public school system? And so maybe you could explain a little bit how this played out in Newark.
Again, it's important to kind of understand a little bit of the history about what happens in Newark, which is important to understand it. By understanding what's happening in Newark, we can also understand what's happening in other places. And so in 1967, Newark has, you know, what Newarkers call a rebellion. Others call it a riot. And again, Newark is not alone here. Just a couple of weeks after that, Detroit has its own rebellion. And in fact, there's over 160 of these uprisings in cities throughout the United States in 1967. And so in 1968, the governor of New Jersey produces this report, commissions a report, and they say that one of the critical issues about that led to this kind of frustration that led to this uprising in Newark was the schools. Number one, the schools were underfunded and they weren't producing an adequate education for Black children in Newark. Literally, there weren't enough seats for all Black children in the Newark school districts. So that was one major problem. The other problem was that although by 1967, African Americans represented the majority of the population in Newark, they had only one school board, Black school board member in the city of Newark. And so politically, that was also a problem, which led to the type of resentment and frustration that produces the conditions for this rebellion. And so Newarkers, Black Newarkers in particular, are responding to this. One way that they respond is a rebellion, but soon thereafter, as they gain political empowerment, they're fighting for more resources to improve education in Newark and other cities in New Jersey. And New Jersey becomes the first state in the country to really make significant gains through the court system to provide more resources for these school districts. So the first court case is in 1973 in what's known as Robinson v. Cahill. And then by 1985, we start to see this other case, Abbott v. Burke, where we start to see significant promises for these urban school districts to gain more resources for their schools. And it's precisely at this time where the courts are making these decisions to provide more resources for their schools that Republican governor and Republican state legislators start to move towards pass this law to take over school districts in Newark, in New Jersey, and with Newark in mind as the largest city in the state.
Now, you described some really interesting school board meetings that you attended. For those that haven't attended a school board meeting, what transpires at a typical meeting, such as the ones that you may have attended? And what does that say about the way in which communities are responding to the new composition of local school boards after a takeover? How organized were the residents of Newark in response to this? And were these school board meetings places of democracy? Did you sort of witness democracy going on, or what actually happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is kind of actually related to your previous question. So when I arrived to Newark to study state takeovers, this is back in 2012, I came with all of the kind of narratives, all the data, all of the literature that was written on the Newark takeover. And all of that, there was a consensus based on newspaper accounts, based on the state report, based on academic literature, that the reason why the state had taken over the school district in Newark was because at some level, the community had failed to produce an adequate education for children, for the children of Newark. And so when I arrived to Newark and started attending school board meetings, I quickly realized that, you know, this is what I'm seeing contradicts this kind of consensus that somehow the community had failed to produce an adequate education. And so the first school board meeting I attend, there's, about 150 people in attendance. And I remember this one woman and talking at the school board meeting, saying that she was disappointed that there weren't more people at a school board meeting in Newark because of all of the issues that the school district has. And so, you know, I had attended school board meetings in other places, and 150 people was a lot. And so I was surprised to hear that this woman say this. And in fact, on average, that year, 2012-2013 school year, 300 people attended school board meetings on average every month. And you know, these are fiery places where meetings where you know, the community comes out and to defend their students, to demand more out of the administration, in this particular case, the state administration, to demand that students with special needs get the care that they deserve, and all of these issues that we know as parents and communities, all of these kinds of things that people care about, Newark was no different. And in fact, I wanted to suggest that they were unique in some way because the level of participation that I saw there and you know, I studied other school districts. What I saw there, you usually don't see in other places. And so the narrative that somehow this community cares less or is incapable of adequately taking care of their kids is just not is not consistent with reality. It's not consistent with the facts. And that's what kind of also propelled this book in a way, is trying to examine that notion that somehow that this community was incapable of doing this. And what I find actually is that it's precisely because they care and precisely because they're demanding more resources and precisely because they're demanding that they be recognized as citizens that they are, that creates a type of political response, which eventually leads to takeovers.
And in the interest of time, where are we now? You have these two different cases that play out in very different ways. We've been focusing a little bit more on Newark, but are the schools in Newark still taken over by the state? Where is the politics of Newark related to schools today, which is not the focus of your book, but I think is germane for understanding the legacies and the lasting impact of these takeovers on local politics. So where's Newark today?
Yeah, so Newark recently regained local control of its schools. So this past February, they had their first school board meeting where the state was no longer in control. So, and that was a result of kind of like a resistant movement, you know, that lasted for over 20 years. And most recently by strong student mobilization, which eventually led to the governor, Chris Christie at the time, coming to the negotiating table to finally produce the kind of path toward local control. And so Newark has local control now. There is a Democratic governor in the state of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, who is, you know, and I argue about this, when you have a Democratic administration that depends on Democratic voters like the city of Newark, Newark being the largest city in the state of New Jersey, most of the voters are Democratic. So that's going to lead to a different type of relationship between local administration and state administration, which may produce, at least for these 4 years, the type of kind of climate that can lead to more positive education experience for the children of Newark. However, you know, and I argue about this in the book, that even, you know, even with a Democratic administration, cities like Newark, that they have to depend on these types of kind of co-partisan relationships in order to have the type of climate, the type of environment that is conducive to producing positive education outcomes is highly problematic. Because in the next 4 years, you might get a different type of administration. And so we really need to think about arranging our politics in terms of education to make it less volatile, less dependent on co-partisan relationships between state and local authorities in order to produce good education outcomes for all students.
Yeah, the book, and I sure hope that the follow-up book is focused on what you're just describing now, because the current book, Takeover, Race, Education, and American Democracy, published by Oxford University Press, is just so very interesting. Again, you've been hearing from Domingo Borrell about this book. Domingo, thank you very much for your time today.
No, thank you. Thank you.